Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me once again is my co-host, Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome back, Anna.
Thanks, Ben. This is going to be a good one.
Oh, we're on fire tonight. We're both in a very clear-minded place. We're both operating at peak efficiency. 50 years ago, on the 19th of February, 1971, the film Cold Turkey, written, directed, and produced by the television impresario Norman Lear, was released to a public that was not necessarily looking for it or expecting it, but had been for just under a month experiencing his extraordinarily long-running, well-regarded television show, All in the Family, which started broadcasting just under a month earlier in January of 1971. And so much so that the New York Times reviews couldn't stop but say, this comes to us from the man that has started a national conversation on how much can you love a bigot, based on the character of Carol O'Connor in All in the Family. Famous macho man named Carol. It's not the only connection back to our previous episode in this movie. Starring Dick Van Dyke as a preacher who exhorts a town in Iowa to stop smoking for 30 days in order to get the town 25 million tax-free dollars in order to inject some life into their sadly depressed community. This film has almost no profile on the landscape. It's not the first film that Norman Lear wrote. It is his directorial debut, but it's largely unheralded and largely not thought about. Anna, what did you think about Cold Turkey?
It was all right. It took me a couple tries to get into, which is not uncommon for some of these movies that we watch from this era. I guess I can see why it's not really kept around from the archives in this era. I thought that it was a good satire, but the characters didn't really move me in a way that I would want to return to.
So you thought that the statements it was making were either effective or funny, but the human side of it wasn't there?
I think so, yeah. I mean, watching it, it's like it's grotesque, it's distressing. I thought it hit a lot of different notes in like who it was skewering and how. But in terms of how we connect to the characters, there wasn't anyone where I was like, oh, this is an interesting or relatable character that I think that I wouldn't really recommend this movie to anyone in terms of like its pure enjoyment. It was good, solid. But not, but I didn't get to the end and feel like, oh, this was brilliant. And this was like eminently rewatchable or something that I really connected to personally.
Interesting. So just before the actual anniversary of this film on the social network Letterboxd, there was a review by comedy writer and noted podcast personality Demi Adijuibe. What I thought was just a fascinating coincidence that a movie we were about to see suddenly showed up in my feed. Demi says in his review that he had a friend of his recommend that he watch it, and that he said he knew he was going to love it from the premise alone, but it's better than he expected. Just A-plus fucking satire. So goofy and great. I just read a comparison of it to a live-action Simpsons episode and think that that's so spot on. So I was extraordinarily surprised that just a couple weeks ago, a noted writer on The Good Place and one of these people that pops up over the internet with huge number of accolades and lavish attention just happened to stumble onto a film that we were going to cover and found it incredibly favorable. Surprised me. And yet, I don't see like this film having lots of other people also find it. Like, it is, it's not necessarily easy to find. It's not on a bunch of streaming services. It's not extraordinarily accessible. Norman Lear has had this enormous renaissance of recently. A lot of tributes. There's a documentary on Netflix, which is a restreaming of a PBS documentary that came out right around his 93rd birthday. The Netflix show One Day at a Time, I believe is what it's called, is a Hispanic remake of a classic sitcom by him. He's really undergoing this extraordinary moment of people saying he is the creator of the sitcoms that we all grew up watching. And as somebody who grew up without a television, I find this all to be very fascinating, that this is the thing that other people are so in touch with. And so I'm interested whether or not this worked for you, Anna. Like, did you grow up with a series of reruns? Did you watch All in the Family or Maude or Good Times with the Jeffersons? Were these part of your get home from school afternoon repeat programming of what was life like in the 70s and therefore acculturating you towards American norms?
No, we had a TV, but we didn't have cable. And I was allowed to watch like a little bit of TV, but it was definitely like a PBS kind of thing. So I'm definitely one of those like weird kids who was under TV'd.
There's a television writer whose Twitter handle is Squid Eat Squid, a humorous update on Dog Eat Dog, who had an interview with Lear. And she was born in, if I recall correctly, 86 or thereabouts. And so it is still a thing that people who are younger than I am could still come up. Now, admittedly, she's a television writer and she's a sitcom writer. So if she's looking for inspiration, she's going to be looking to classic sitcoms that came out of the Norman Lear factory mentality. And upon his retirement, he estimated that he'd had 16 different series on the air and over 700 hours of television. So wildly influential, just kind of interesting that his sphere has never overlapped with mine. I feel like, I mean, I'm not a comedy sitcom writer. It is interesting to me that he is this heralded persona. And I see his name put up on pedestals more and more frequently these days by writers in writer circles.
Mm-hmm.
And yet his directorial debut isn't heralded.
Well, maybe not yet. I don't know. Maybe we'll come back around to it. Maybe Big Tobacco just buried this movie and people don't love it because they haven't been able to get their hands on it.
Possibly. I'm not dismissing it out of hand. I just don't have any evidence one way or the other.
We don't need evidence. This is the age of conspiracy theories. I'll make a YouTube video to go along with the episode.
Well, that'll do it. That'll definitely get people on your side. I took a look at his memoir, Even This I Get to Experience, and was interested as to what he had to say about the making of the movie. And my main takeaway was that the film was made in between versions of All in the Family. That he got the rights to the British version that he based All in the Family on, a show on the BBC called Till Death Do Us Part, sometime in 1968. And he made a pilot for it for ABC in between 1968 and 1969, called Justice for All, and then went back and made a second pilot for the show called Those Were the Days, both of which ABC said, no, it's not good enough, we're not going to pick it up. Upon learning from ABC that they weren't going to go to series with it, he threw up his hands and said, well, then I guess I'm going to go make this movie. Upon completing the movie and during the editing process, he had a cut of Cold Turkey that he was sufficiently satisfied with that it got him a 3-picture deal as writer, director, producer on more films, which therefore got his name buzzy enough that he was able to put his ABC pilot under the noses of some people in CBS, who then said, this is great, we want to reshoot this as a pilot, make it for CBS, and turn it into a series, at which point it then came out a month before Cold Turkey did. The success of All in the Family happened around the same time he was making this movie, but overshadowed it almost completely. He became the television maven at the same time that his directorial career could have been taking off. But instead, it seems as if he then focused on television. So I don't think it's not just culture that has forgotten this movie. I think it's also clear from Lear's own perspective that this is a footnote.
Well, it also seems like this movie is very topical. Like, I assume that for, like, I'm not familiar with, like, his TV series, but it seems like they have, like, a really broad appeal, you know, like, they were very palatable to the masses, I assume. Whereas this movie, I think, if you are a smoker, it might be funny, but it also might be really uncomfortable. If you aren't a smoker, it might be funny, but it also might be kind of boring and unrelatable. I think that some of it doesn't, you know, we talk about whether or not movies age well. I think that there's some things that do age well and are still relevant. But I think other aspects of it don't really land, you know, because smoking just doesn't have the same place in the culture that it used to. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Well, my question is this a movie about smoking? Or is smoking the vehicle for a satire about other things?
Smoking is the vehicle, for sure. But I think if the vehicle isn't relevant, then I think that the satire loses its punch.
And also it loses its attractiveness.
Right.
If there isn't enough in culture, if there isn't enough smoking culture at the moment, then somebody seeing, oh, this is a satire about smoking, isn't going to say, well, that's worth my 2 hours, in order to then find the upending of the power structures that maybe the film is more closely about.
Yeah, and that, you know, a 50-year-old satire might not land as well either, you know, that like a satire in its moment might, you know, be hilarious and like wonderful and like feel really good. But, you know, after 10 years or 20 years or 50 years, it might hold up really well. I think there's probably some really good examples of that. I think that there's some moments where it's like, oh, I see what they're doing there.
Oh, the ultimate damnation. Oh, I see what they're doing there. The faintest of faint praise.
I didn't mean it to be so harsh. But I guess that's as inadvertently honest as that was, like, maybe that's kind of the point, is, you know, with, like, they're sort of skewering the hippie kids, you know, like, at the time, maybe that was really funny, you know, but now it's just sort of like, yeah, like, they're making fun of the protesters, like, yeah, I get it.
So, just for context, one of the arcs of the film is the main character, is played by Dick Van Dyke, is a reverend in a depressed Iowa town.
That's why you were selected for Eagle Rock, to make it a strong and vital parish again.
But, Bishop, this is a depressed area.
And he sees this as an effort for the town to band together to create community and civic pride so that they can restore a fractured community. The opening title sequence is a long, slow pan of the road leading to the town, showing signs on either side of the road that basically show how any industry that the town might have had has shut down or left, except for 12 different churches. So once the town does start to come together and starts to rebuild in solidarity of their struggle to quit smoking, and they are seen as a national example of willpower, there is, as Anna mentioned, a protest of teenagers in the town marching in a sad circle. There may be 8 to 10 of them holding placards and marching around in a mild desultory spiral that nobody really seems to notice except for the Reverend, except for Dick Van Dyke, who finds what they're doing incredibly disrespectful.
This is wrong, Dennis. I don't understand you kids. Eagle Rock's moving again. It's found itself. It's found its pride.
You say that you think this is a satire of youth.
I think just that particular moment, I think that they're taking the opportunity to sort of take a poke at the protest culture or like the anti-authoritarian culture. I mean, there's so many things that this movie covers. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that the connection to like a Simpsons is like pretty apt because there's just so much packed in. And I think that there's another group that I think is sort of supposed to represent maybe like a John Birch Society or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's another example of like the satire is there and it's funny, it's solid, but I'm just not sure that it, like, I wouldn't have known that if I, you know, if I hadn't been reading reviews about the movie afterwards.
Hmm.
It's funny because the characters are funny and the conflict is funny, but the groups, I think, like, are not, like, that particular group is no longer relevant as far as the protesters.
I'm not saying that
the group is no longer around, but I feel like it's not in the, it's not at the surface of like cultural consciousness in the same way that it would have been then.
There are four different constituents who are listed as sort of the last holdouts as the town is approaching midnight and there's hardly anybody left to sign up. And the Reverend has to go around and strong arm the last people. The first is the local doctor in town who has a 4-pack-a-day habit and absolutely swears that he can't give up smoking. And he is
for medical
forced.
Reasons.
Yes, he says he's congenitally unable to quit for medical reasons.
My family has a long history of hypertension. I had two aunts who blew their corks and a sister who's liable to go at any moment. The only thing that's held me together is smoking.
And he is strong-armed, basically blackmailed into agreeing to quit by the banker who is on the town council threatening to revoke the lease for his hospital. There is a town drunk who says that he smokes because he drinks and he can't stop drinking.
You understand, Reverend? The booze bone is connected to the smoke bone.
And then there is, as you say, the Christopher Mott Society, a strange group of people who are scared of communists, but who are non-smokers, who seem to be pure and abstentious in most aspects.
They just don't want to be told what to do, quote unquote.
And Amos, your members don't smoke.
Well, even if we don't smoke, we don't want you telling us what to do. There's enough big government messing in our individual affairs.
And they take great joy in going on to enforce the no smoking.
And I found them to be an incredibly current satire of conservatives in the United States.
Oh, that's interesting.
Who just absolutely hate any government interference in their lives.
Our guest speaker needs very little introduction to the members of the Christopher Mott Society, author of the best-selling Hello, Big Government, Goodbye, America.
And who, given a moment's notice, will turn into fascists. I mean, that's what the leader of the Christopher Mott Society wants. His name is Amos. The second he is given a chance to police the people who have quit smoking, he's like, can we wear armbands? Can we wear hats? And at the very end, as he's clambering up on stage for the final minutes before they make it to their 30 days, he has progressed from being a man in a paper hat who looks like your standard elk to being somebody in a true Nazi uniform. He's got brown khakis with a belt with a strap across the chest. He has gone all the way to true fascism over the course of the 30 days. That kind of example of people who say that they don't want the government to be in their lives, but who, given a chance, will then police everybody else, I think is incredibly relevant today.
No, I think you're not wrong. I think this is it's a very good connection. I think that the thing that feels very distant is that we don't have now something that looks like these groups, just the way that they look. You know, I just feel like that's some of the thing that I run into sometimes with these movies is just like the way things look and how people sound when they talk about things just feels like old. It's unrelatable because there's not like a club. We might have people who are thinking and acting in the same ways, but they don't get together every Saturday to have a club about it.
They don't sit quietly in chairs and listen to a record of their leader.
Exactly.
They go out into the backyard. They meet up on message boards. They shoot tin cans with AK-47s, but they don't quietly wait for their inspiration.
So I think that your read on it is very apt. And I think that for somebody who's willing to watch this movie on just a slightly deeper level, I think that's a great connection. But on like a slightly more surface level, it can feel maybe a little bit more inaccessible.
What I was going to say earlier is that I don't think the kids are being satirized in the protest. I think they're there to show how inadvertently corrupt the Reverend has become.
I think that they're both being satirized.
Okay. I don't see anything that particularly makes the kids' protest laughable, except for the fact that it clearly is outnumbered by the town. that they are youth culture, and that he paints them as ungrateful youth is a quick and easy label for somebody in the establishment to throw at them. And I think one of them shouts something along the lines of, you can't trust anybody over 30.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's why I didn't feel like it was not sympathetic to them, nor were they like plot essential.
But they're part of his arc of going from somebody who can't see his own flaws to starting to realize that what he's done in order to save the town is destroying the town, that it's becoming over-commercialized, that they're selling banner ads to giant liquor billboards, that they've turned their whole main square. It's now full of tourists and visitors, but also they're selling photographs of the town leaders, and they're just, it's a carnival of commercialism. He then starts to see that what he's created has turned and is ruining the town.
The spirit of the community the last time I was here, but now this vitality, this energy,
this greed, this avarice,
this unity of purpose.
Just anything for a buck.
And is almost about to do something about it until his local bishop shows him that he has been placed as the figure on the cover of Time magazine, and then all of his reservations are washed away through bingo. And he's then so full of himself that he won't hear another word against what's going on, even when his wife raises the same concerns he was just having, quoting scripture to him to show him how far he's wandered from the path. I'm going to abandon that previous verb.
You're going to use my own words against me? He says to her.
How will it profit the town to gain the whole world and lose its own soul?
You quoted scripture to me.
And what's her comeback? Marvelous. One of the better lines in the script.
Those are God's words.
Right.
He's such a jerk to her. It's horrible from like the beginning of the movie.
Which is, yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, because he is the main, you know, the satirization of the opportunistic, craven quality of a small American town that will do anything, that will prostitute itself in order to have a small economic recovery, is obviously part of this major satire of the film. But him as the figurehead, as the person who's trying to do something well, but only in order to get a congregation that listens to him, to use it as a springboard to get to a better small town someplace else where he doesn't have to work so hard. And then he turns into this person who's just proud of his own glory.
But he was always proud of his own glory.
Yes.
There's that one scene, though, which I really love, where he's like trying to get the town whipped up and excited, like to quit cigarettes. And it and it's amazing. I feel like this is like a Dick Van Dyke that I don't really know. I feel like I know like Mary Poppins, and I know like his later detective years. But
yes, with the mustache.
Yeah. But this is like, you know, he's very like physically dynamic, and it has all these scenes cutting back and forth between him, like really whipping the crowd into a frenzy. And part of what it shows him doing is like reaching up and sort of like crunching his curls on top of his head.
Yes. Yes, he's constantly constantly patting his hair back into place.
Yeah, and it's honestly, it was one of the funniest fucking things in the whole movie. Like, it was those moments where I was like, that's brilliant. Like, that's really good. Like, it's just really small, and it's the kind of thing that's no accident. You know, like, sometimes when you're watching a movie, it's like, oh, like, did the actor decide to do that? Like, was that a director thing? Like, what was that decision about? Was that inadvertent? And it's like, that was no accident. And that's super brilliant. Like, whoever decided that that was how they were going to take that character and, like, like play
that
scene.
Show how superficial he really is.
Yeah, that, like, whatever his deal is, that, like, he's, like, developed this little thing where he's got to, like, reach up and, like, crunch his little curls back into place. It was just so good. And I think that there were actually lots of little things like that. Another one, I'm probably going to, like, do the show backwards where we do, like, our our five favorite scenes. I'm doing them now. But there's a scene where after, like, the big, I guess it was, like, a New Year's party, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the morning after, the Reverend's, like, running by all these people who are having, like, their morning hangover ritual, going out to get the paper, whatever. And this one lady, she's, like, out on her stoop. And she goes to clear her nasal passages, and then she sees the Reverend, and she, like, swallows a loogie. And it was the most disgusting and hilarious thing. And it was so unexpected. And it was the crossroads of this lady who's kind of nice, but also, like, kind of vulgar, seeing him and then making the decision to, like, swallow this loogie that she's just unearthed. Hilarious. That's peak comedy. Like, if there's a reason to recommend this movie, it's like that. That would be the reason why. Like, those unexpected things. Like, what a commitment for them. That actress to be like, oh yeah, let's do this.
It's brilliantly observed too, the idea that somebody, the actor, the director, the writer, whomever, came up with that, and that they did it in a naturalistic way instead of highlighting it.
Mm-hmm.
Not dissimilar to when the Reverend is walking through the crowds and he starts to understand just how terrible this is, just how much this is the money changers in the temple. You get his POV of the people running past him, but you can see almost any other director going to a fisheye lens, doing Dutch tilts so that it's all, oh my gosh, Carnival of Terror sort of stuff going on. But they just played it straight. This is what he's seeing. They cut down the sound mix slightly so that you get the soundtrack doing its normal calliope stuff, but in a slightly minor key. But that's about all that they do to over-egg the scenario. Similarly, they could have really zoomed in on that actress, putting a finger on one nostril that she was really going to blow her nose out. They could have done a close-up. They could have had her face freeze in terror as she realized. Instead, they kept it in a wide shot, and they had her watch him run by. That you either caught it or you didn't. First time I watched that scene, I was just interested in the weirdness of, like, the Reverend as sex symbol. That, you know, part of her morning routine was not just post-party emphysema, but also that she was going out to get the paper in order to watch his ass as he ran by.
That's funny. There was a scene that was really overdone. I think it was, like, maybe the scene right after that where, like, he goes to visit Carol, the guy who played Carol in Little Murders.
Yes, yes, we have a return of the father from Little Murders is the mayor of this town.
And his wife is being absolutely disgusting. Honestly, this is, like, the first thing I really noticed about this movie is just, like, that it really leaned into this sort of, like, grotesque atmosphere, and it really didn't hold back.
Played by Jean Stapleton, who was the wife of Carol O'Connor in All in the Family and had been that in the previous two ABC pilots. So she had already started to be a Norman Lear staple. And he brought her in to play this part. And yeah, she's not heavily in the movie, but you're right. She has three, I would say, major moments. And the first of them is that she's constantly sneezing.
It's gross.
Maybe 3 minutes of just in the background as they're waiting for the news broadcast that announces the competition.
$1 million. combination. $98 for the Ortho Posture Inner Spring combination. Choose famous sports mattresses.
And they're sitting through an insufferable number of station identifications and ads. As you say, that Simpsons X quality of we're just going to satirize how dumb commercial television is for 3 minutes because why not? Let's just also poke fun at how many ads there are on TV. And they fill the time with her just walking around the kitchen sneezing.
It was bizarre. It was gross. I mean, I don't even find people sneezing gross, and it was gross. And it went on forever.
And she boxed Colonial, Danish Modern, or French Provincial. All six items for only $148. Drive now to Brin's Electricity.
You can't tell me that scene wasn't completely over the top. Like, as subtle as some of these other scenes were, that particular scene was absurd.
She has two other major moments, the second of which is she's part of the town meeting where she reveals just how many kickbacks the town's leadership is starting to get as commercialism has started to wend its way into the community. But before that, you have the day of the first day of non-smoking. She is stuffing her face with salami wrapped around pickles and toast.
Oh, right. And also,
I had 5 gherkins before I decided to wrap them in salami. And this is my second carrot. That's 2 carrots, 6 slices of salami, 11 gherkins, and I haven't counted them. And it isn't even 7 o'clock yet.
That was, to me, of the three moments, that was the one that was the over-the-top gross one.
Yeah. It was unpleasant.
Unpleasant is, I think, part of the tone, though. So the film opens with an extended sequence with the old man Tobacco.
It opens on a Confederate flag.
Opens on a Confederate flag on his mansion, yes. as our boy, the new scrappy young agent for Southern Tobacco, explains how in order to go down in history as a revered figure, you have to wipe people's minds away from the damage you've done. The way that Alfred Nobel is thought of as the founder of the Nobel Peace Prize and not as the inventor of dynamite.
One of the great contributors to modern warfare. Made $1 billion selling munitions.
And a perfectly good starting point for the idea of cultural rehabilitation. But it's this extended monologue of this ancient Southern man being wheeled around. He's clearly horrible. And there's a Confederate flag all over the place. I was like, oh, wait, it's the opening to Brewster McCloud. Well, he gets killed very quickly in a piece of schadenfreude. But I thought it was fascinating that it was that same imagery of Southern elderly, terrible people. That grotesquery is very much in Brewster. Did you find it off-putting there as you did here?
Yeah, but I don't know why I responded to it differently here.
Was it not consistently grotesque enough?
I think that Brewster was just so weird that it felt different.
That maybe something about this brand of satire was too actual. And so that kind of ugly human manners needed to be in something weirder, like a fallen angel trying to convince a boy to fly in the Astrodome.
Yeah.
In order for it to be palatable.
Yeah. I think when it's like so off the rails, like having things be like grotesque or distressing or weird, like doesn't even really, it didn't register that.
It's
badly.
All of a piece.
Yeah. Whereas in this, it's like, and I get it. That's kind of the point. It's like a little town in Iowa and everyone's in church and everyone, you know, and that's like the whole point of making it grotesque is so that it hits. But also like, ew.
The actual real life stakes of this, the fact that people die of cancer from smoking all the time, the fact that the cigarette companies are trying to convince people that they're good guys, but in fact, they're continuing to sell things that kill people. That it took until 1994 for cigarette companies to admit that they actually might cause death. And that people would be so willing to sell out their principles in order to make millions of dollars. And that even that would become a sticking point. There's that marvelous scene where at the very end, when they're about to get the check, somebody jumps up on the stage and says,
"Are we done $25 million? $1,000 coming, and I figure if you divide it among the 4,000 residents of Eagle Rock, it comes to a little over $6,000 a head.
This thing that they've all been working for collectively for the good of the many then suddenly becomes, no, I want my piece of it. All of that is very realistic and very ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe not funny enough, because even though you say, eh, I don't really believe that there are that kind of John Birch societies. Yeah, this sort of small town doesn't really exist anymore. It's still the motivations and the types of people are still very real.
Yeah. I have a question. Do we think that this is about tobacco? Because I feel like earlier you were saying like this movie isn't necessarily about tobacco. And also, do we think that it's wrong to participate in this kind of a challenge for $25 million?
I think that tobacco, the addiction to tobacco, is the thing that creates the tension that allows the ordinary layer of civility to be ripped off society. So we have those marvelous scenes of, so the agent for the tobacco companies is played by
Bob Newhart.
Yes, thank you.
I studied.
And Newhart plays this marvelously slimy guy. He actually comes to town with a car packed full of hidden cigarettes in order to try and smuggle them into the people so that they'll break their pledge and the cigarette company won't have to pay out the $25 million.
And a lighter shaped like a gun.
Wanders around town with a lighter shaped like a gun, just lighting things sticking out of people's mouths, hoping that they're a cigarette.
Spoiler alert, it doesn't end well.
What? Walking around with a thing shaped like a gun might have adverse effects? I don't think that any black people in the United States would be able to agree with that statement. Even things not shaped like a gun. But he has a couple of scenes where he calls from a phone booth in the town square back to South Carolina in order to report on what's going on.
Only been here a few days. Here's the fill.
The town is falling apart.
When I say come home now,
they're at each other's throats.
He's crazy. I don't
care. Wanna know what you gotta worry about? Nothing.
And you have a couple of montages of people just beating the crap out of each other, including what may have been one of my top five favorite moments, where somebody punts a punt dog across the square.
I really love dogs. And before I watched that scene, I heard about it. I heard that it was going to happen. And
oh my gosh, really?
Yeah. And because I was like reading some reviews, which normally I don't read stuff about the movie before I watched it, but that's what happened this time. And
because you had such a hard time getting through it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. There's like a couple of attempts before I got to the punt dog scene, and I heard you know some people who are really upset about it, and then I read at least like one review where the person was like, I don't understand why all these people think that this scene kicking the dog is so funny. I think it's actually pretty terrible. So that's what I read, and then I saw the scene, and again, as somebody who loves dogs, I wasn't really sure what I was in for, but I gotta say it's pretty funny when you see it. So
I mean, you're not supposed to be in favor of the dog being kicked. Let's
be
clear.
I think that's really important to note, is like, it's not funny to hurt animals. What's funny is that it's unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
And
it shows just how far people in this town have gone.
Yeah.
The fact that I find it funny means that I'm already there.
That's a personal thing about you.
But I would also never do it, because I have terrible hand-foot coordination. The truth of the matter is that all of this is to show just how bad everybody's gotten. The addiction to tobacco is the vehicle for that. He could have chosen almost anything. It could have been you could have set it in Las Vegas or Reno and had it been about gambling. You could have had it be about drinking. Dick Van Dyke, in one of his memoirs, writes about trying to quit smoking and failing, going to an aversion therapy session and immediately lighting up afterwards and having the person hand him his money back and just being like, yeah, there's nothing we can do for you. And using those experiences to write up a pitch for Lear, which Lear says, this is interesting, we're working on something already based on this unpublished novel. So they were thinking along similar lines. It started off as it's really hard to quit smoking. Therefore, what would that drive somebody to do?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that that's what the satire is ultimately about. I think the fact that it's hard to do something creates the tension and the strain that the people then have to fight against. Is the Lysistrata actually about sex, or is it about gender relations and how sex is the thing that, taking it away, reveals the breakdown of relationships in society?
Mm. So if we don't think it's about tobacco, then we think it's about the selling out and the greed. And is it bad to have participated in that? I just want to get one thing straight here. So
yeah,
is
yeah,
it
yeah, yeah.
Is there like a core criticism of the town for having participated in this anyway, because it means that they are sort of like propping up the evil tobacco industry, and so they're complicit? Is that one theory?
What's the end of the movie?
The end of the movie is that Nixon comes to town. Nixon's hands come to town, and they win a defense contract. They have a missile factory with four gleaming black smoke spouting smokestacks.
The photography of the Nixon stand-in, as Anna has implied, is wonderful. Like, you basically see tall Secret Service guards and Nixon's victory hands behind them with his head just below camera. It's a really, really sharp way of showing the president without having to worry how much about he actually looks like the president, whatever stand-in they got.
It also
it emasculates the man too, which is great. 1971 is the year of the Pentagon Papers. This is when, in July of 71, is when you have the release of the classified documents that are published in first the New York Times and then the Washington Post. And towards the end of 71, the beginning of 72, is the Watergate break-in. So this is right at the heart of Nixon starting to get paranoid about re-election.
Mm.
So the idea that, I don't know, just it's such a wonderful scene that as they're arguing about what to do with the money, this general comes in and says,
"If you can postpone the presentation ceremony until day after tomorrow, the president says you can all come down to Washington and be photographed on TV right there on the East Lawn with him."
And they just dismiss him out of hand. Like, the president carries no water whatsoever. What the town has achieved is significant. That's why the president comes to town, in order to bathe in their reflected glory. So to partially answer your question, Anna, yes, of course what they did is great. It was an act of will and solidarity, but they did it badly on every front. They lost perspective, which is why they accepted the military contract, which is why they created a giant missile factory that's effectively four giant cigarettes.
But they wanted the military contract for giant cigarettes. That's funny. I didn't make that connection. But they, I mean, that's what they had before. Like, in the opening scene, we see that, like, before, one of the main industries in town was
an Air Force base, yes.
Yeah, an Air Force base. And so it seems like not too far off from like exactly what they would have wanted. And like we see the military bigwig, that's part of like the conversation that he has with the Reverend, like at the beginning of the movie. He's like, you know,
when they move their families into a new town, they expect a first-rate high school, fine library, tip-top hospital facilities, a good police force, attractive shopping centers, etc.
Gotta get this place whipped into shape.
The reason they want the $25 million is to rehabilitate the town enough that a military contractor would set up business there. All 100% correct. But they go too far somehow. They turn it into just a carnival of selling themselves and selling their hubris. People look to them and come to them. They get their fake Walter Cronkite to show up a couple of times in order
Walter
to report.
Chronic.
Yes. In order to show off to the nation how wonderful they are. And it turns into the town is just a celebration of look at what we're able to accomplish. That's pride.
Yeah, but so what? I just think like, okay, so if you made this movie today and you're like, there's this town in, I'm going to pick on West Virginia. There's this town in West Virginia. It has 4,000 people. They don't have any industry. We're going to give them $25 million if everyone in town stops smoking pot. The point is like, to like go to like a depressed town and to dangle $25 million in order to have an opportunity, but you have to give up something that you love and is like the one thing that you have that like makes your shitty life okay. If the point of the movie is like, fuck you, little town, like you're such like shitty, short-sighted assholes for like wanting to take $25 million.
I'm not going to be able to edit all the swears.
I didn't know you edit out swears.
I just have to label it differently. That's all.
Let me take that from the top. All right. So
seriously, we'd crossed that line already. You just happened to throw five of them in one sentence.
Okay. So I will try to find more refined and specific language moving forward. But you know, I mean, I think you get the point that I'm driving at, which is sort of blaming the victim. If you go into like a town that's economically depressed and you're like, well, we can give you this money, but then we're going to take you to task for taking us up on the opportunity. And I just feel like the whole like the circus thing is just a function of they're trapped in a satire. They don't know. That's the director. That's not them. You know what I mean?
So part of me wants to argue the premise. In that the first scene of the film is this is impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody can give up smoking for a week, let alone a month. There's no way 4,000 people in a town can do this.
Right. That's a slimy Bob Newhart tobacco yes. guy character saying that.
And that's what sells them on the idea of we will make this offer in order to make us look like good people, despite the fact that nobody can do it. And then only one town is even able to get the 100% signatures to do it.
Yeah.
There aren't any other contestants.
Mm-hmm.
And then what do we see? 20 out of the 30 days is spent with everybody hating everything until they start showing that kind of terrible, lascivious pride that says, look at us, we're better than you. We're going to sell the fact that we're better than you. That's the way they're able to band together to get through it.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do it out of pride. They don't go running every day. They don't find good substitutions. There's, in fact, the extended substitution scene with the Reverend where he hears on the radio that one of the ways in which you can substitute the oral gratification of smoking is
to the married non-smoker, I often suggest another compensation, the act of physical love.
You don't mean...
Yes, I do mean that, and I hope it's all right to say on the radio.
And you then have these terrible mechanical moments between him and his already depressed, alienated wife, where she's just allowing herself to be, you know, she lies back and thinks of $25 million. One review I read was like, that was the lowest of the low points. I have to say, I laughed. But I laughed because I thought the actress did a great performance of showing just how sick she was of it.
Yeah, I thought that she was really awesome.
They don't do it for the right reasons, and they don't get anything out of it except more different kinds of pollution and the orgasmic return to smoking.
Mm-hmm.
I've just been reading a chapter of a book on humor that says the essential nature of a comedy. I've always been told in the past that a comedy is where everybody gets married at the end. A tragedy is where everybody dies at the end. But he defines it as, I believe the author's name is Terry Eagleton. He says that a comedy is where you have a circumstance that is able to be resolved. And so a satire is when a circumstance is resolved badly. It comes to a resolution, but it comes to a resolution through terrible means or by means that you're not supposed to support. We don't support this man, this reverend. He does things badly and for the wrong reasons, and he pays the price. The town does things badly and for the wrong reasons and pays the price. It's resolved. They get what they wanted. They get what they fight for, but it doesn't actually make their lives better. It just replaces one kind of circumstance with another terrible circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can get on board that, like, they're bad people and everyone's doing everything for the wrong reasons and so on and so forth. I think that just like the core of the satire doesn't feel... I think we're just having the same conversation that we have every time, which is like, what does this mean? And what are they trying to say? It just doesn't seem like there's a whole lot to criticize. Like, they're bad people and they're selfish and narcissistic and they are end up full of pride and it's a circus and all this other stuff. But in terms of like a thing to criticize, it doesn't seem
that you know deep.
Do you know what I mean? Like, oh, like you.
Oh, look, people like, are bad and easily
right,
corruptible.
Like you quit smoking for a month as a town and you all went a little like off your rockers and weren't very nice to each other. Like, I don't know, the whole like people are kind of bad thing. People are kind of bad when there's money involved or like people are kind of bad when there's like addiction involved. It's not, it doesn't feel super deep to me, you know?
No. But is it a funny? Is it amusing? There are two ways to approach this. One, sometimes social change happens better through laughter than it does through didactic criticism. So yeah. Somebody might be more willing to give up smoking by showing just how terrible these people are as they try to give up smoking.
But it's not about smoking. We already talked about that.
But
make up your mind.
Look, if we're going to address the classic authorial intent fallacy in the room, the writer, director, and star said that it was about quitting smoking. Okay. They intended it to be about quitting smoking and a satire thus. I say the end result is that it's a satire about pride and society. But they were both trying to quit smoking and failed over the course of this picture. They had each previously tried to quit smoking and used that as an impetus to create the picture in the first place. I think their intended message may have been quitting smoking is really hard. If we can show how terrible and hard it is, we might have a better empathetic response that might help people and make them laugh rather than saying, gosh, Jimmy, I can't believe you're still smoking. Don't you know that does bad things to your lungs? Well, gee, Bob, no, I didn't. How terrible of me. I better quit now. You know, that kind of fifth grade smoking film is not going to work, but maybe laughter might is one of the premises of the satire chapter in Eagleton's book, that there is a ongoing belief that satire changes more minds than polemic does. So the question is therefore, in my opinion, less is it deep satire and more is it funny?
Did you think it was funny?
I laughed a lot. I didn't walk away saying I need to revisit this. This is going to go on. You know, I'm not going to slap it on every couple of years like Hot Shots Part Deux or Airplane. It's not that level of consistently laugh out loud series of quick, dumb jokes. I think it has a lot of very good, dumb jokes, but maybe not at the pace or at the level of ludicrousness that I particularly enjoy in my dumb humor catalog. I thought the Nixon stuff was great. I thought the drunk guy was great. When we get to our five moments, I'm going to be spoiled for choice.
Yeah.
It didn't fail for me as a movie. I watched it. I was pleasantly surprised. I wasn't excited to rewatch it. When I rewatched it, I laughed again.
That's a good sign.
Yeah. But it didn't work for you. It didn't grab you the first time. It didn't grab you the second time. You had to manacle yourself to your couch to watch it.
It's true. My roommate did put a weighted blanket on me. The second time I sat down to watch it, it was very helpful. It got very cozy.
All right, I have zero transition, so we're just going to plunge ahead into our weekly recap minute. Anna has a link to a 60-second scene chosen randomly by the good people at random.org. She then has 30 seconds to summarize its contents. If she does so successfully, then she has a bonus point as we go into our five-question quiz, the results of which mean absolutely nothing. It's sort of like the classic Whose Line Is It Anywhere, where the points don't matter and the questions are all made up. That's, in fact, 100% what we do here. good people at random.org have selected for Anna minute 85. That's minute 85.
Thank you. I think it's most important for all of us to remember, friends, that Eagle Rock has become a source of inspiration to this nation.
The world.
It's true. And I don't think we can start spending $29 million when all we're going
all
to
All right, Anna. Are you ready?
Yes.
Your 30 seconds begins now.
Okay. The scene opens with the Reverend and the mayor talking together. One of the Sons of the Confederacy is in the background. The Reverend is saying, we can't spend $29 million when we don't even have 25 yet. People start arguing about how to spend the money. The guy from the police, the police officer wants to spend...
10 seconds left.
There's arguments over a police station, a hospital, the doctor...
5 seconds left.
The doctor's breaking down. The room erupts over arguments over how to spend the money.
Time! You haven't done that much build up about nothing in weeks.
I know. I was getting so much better. I don't know what happened.
Well, unfortunately, it means that you have no advantage as we go into our 5 seconds.
How can you
quiz.
Say that? I did I like miss time, or did I not get all the details? Because I really you felt didn't... like I got everything in.
I think the piece that I was looking for was the transition to the quiz. So yes, I'd say fair point. You did get to the final part of the scene. Oh, the piece that I was most looking for was the fact that the doctor believes that because of his personal sacrifice, that the hospital should be named after him.
Oh.
An irrelevant detail, except for the fact that it's the basis for the quiz this week.
To our listeners, if you can see how unfair Ben is being to me and you would like to write in about that, I would appreciate your support.
Perhaps. We'll get to the end of the quiz, and then we'll figure out through virtual thumb wrestling whether or not you get the extra point.
I think everyone knows that this is rigged, so.
Which is why you've won the last two times.
Are you suggesting that you're rigging it in my favor?
I'm suggesting there's no rigging except for when you think it's being rigged.
It's rigged.
Question number one. Of the first hospitals to be called Memorial in these United States, which was named so the earliest? A. The General Memorial Hospital on Manhattan Island. B. The Mary Hitchcock Memorial Hospital in Hanover, New Hampshire. Or C. The Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, Texas.
How about the Sloan Kettering? I'm going to go with B.
Mary Hitchcock was named after her in 1893 and is, in fact, the earliest if you're a pedant. So we're going to go with that. Question number two. Mary Hitchcock Hospital, before being replaced by the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in 1995, was named after Mary Maynard, wife of Hiram Hitchcock. Which of the following is true about the couple? A. Hiram made his fortune by co-founding the Waldorf Astoria in Fifth Avenue, Manhattan, before it was demolished in 1927 to make way for the Empire State Building. B. The two were married after growing up together in Claremont, New Hampshire, but only reuniting in Egypt, where Hiram was traveling to try and restore his health in a different climate at age 34. C. The Mary Hitchcock Memorial Hospital was the home of the Dartmouth Medical School, but which is now named after Dr. Seuss and his wife, Audrey Geisel. D. All of the above. Or E. None of the above.
B.
No, they did travel to Egypt for his health at age 34, but that's not where they met. They had known each other their whole lives in Claremont. It is true that it was named after Dr. Seuss or Ted Geisel and his wife, Audrey. Question number three. The Parkland Memorial Hospital is famous for being where JFK was pronounced dead after his assassination. What else is also true about it? A. It was the first brick building to be built in Texas. B. There is no one named Parkland that the hospital is memorializing. It was simply built on a park. C. Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby also died there. D. All of the above. Or E. None of the above.
E.
None?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, they're all true.
God, whatever. I'm doing the quiz next time.
Good. You'll have to watch the movie to do that. Question number 4. The General Memorial Hospital in Manhattan was also not named in memory of anyone. It was founded in 1884 as the New York Cancer Hospital, but it is now named after someone. Who? A. The Sloan Kettering Institute, named after Alfred P. Sloan and Charles Kettering of General Motors. B. The John Hopkins Hospital, named after 19th century merchant banker. C. The Rockefeller Hospital, named after J.D. Rockefeller. D. All of the above. E. None of the above.
A.
Correct. Question number 5.
Oh my gosh, there's more.
You have 2 correct and 2 wrong, and maybe 30 seconds. So everything hangs in the balance. According to a 2006 article in the American Journal of Public Health, many cigarette advertisements in the 30s and 40s tried to indicate that doctors endorsed consumptions of cigarettes. Which of the following is a real ad slogan? A. 20,679 doctors say that Lucky's are less irritating than the leading brand. B. Dr. Beattie's asthma cigarettes are best for the temporary relief of paroxysms of asthma and other attacks. C. When your throat is dry, when you have a cold, when your voice is hoarse, switch to Spuds cigarettes. D. All of the above. E. None of the above.
D.
All of the above?
I can't take it back now. Yeah, that's what I was going to pick.
Correct.
Oh, it is?
Which means you have an unassailable 3 points from the quiz. So regardless of the verdict of your other points, you are this week's winner, therefore earning you the ability to control the quiz next time.
Wow, I did it.
Well done indeed. And we come to the point in our program where we discuss our 5 favorite moments over the course of the movie. To remind our listeners, a moment is not a full scene, but it is a line of dialogue, a actorly gesture or behavior, an emotion or a sense of a single moment that made us stop or think or smile or react in a way that we wanted to mention. Anna, what's your first moment for tonight?
So I know that I mentioned probably all of the ones that I would have mentioned in this segment, but one that I really enjoyed a lot is a scene where I think you mentioned that there's these masks that people make with a photograph of the Reverend's face on them.
Yes.
And there's one scene in particular where the Reverend is standing sort of like off to the right side of the screen, and all of these little kids run by him towards the camera, like one after another. It's like a fairly long scene, and it's really disorienting. It's like very interesting, and it's kind of an odd moment, but I thought it was really well done.
It's at the heart of his realization that things have gone wrong, is when he sees people wearing his face as a strange thing. And yeah, I think it's a very telling moment.
Yeah.
Excellent. For my second moment, I'm going to go with the confrontation between the town drunk and the Reverend. I particularly enjoyed the way in which he couldn't always say the word Reverend and that he frequently called him Reverman. But I think the part that I enjoyed the most is when he's trying to make his point about his addiction and he asks the preacher, he says, How old do you think I am, Reverend?
How old do you think I am?
Oh, 42?
I'm 42.
And just the line delivery. The guy is a really, really funny actor, but the absolute commitment in that very simple elementary joke, in the way in which he says it, like, no, let me set you straight, I'm going to say the exact same thing that you said, is just a note perfect delivery of that joke. And it was one of the things that made me howl the second time, just because I knew it was coming, and it worked on every level.
Yeah, it's probably one of the best scenes.
I mean, just the whole scene. We talked so much when we in Little Murders about how it was a movie that was made up of vignettes where characters would have an extended moment, and I think that is the extended moment in this movie that stood out to me the most. What's your number three?
My number three is probably not one specific moment, but a character, the little old lady who
yes,
we meet.
Odie, her name is.
What's that?
Her name is Odie, weirdly enough. I, of course, can only think of the dog from Garfield, right. But I don't know what Odie is short for, but you're right. She's a marvelous, beady-eyed, aggressive character actor.
And we meet her in, well, the first time I remember seeing her is this party scene where she's sitting down, she leans over, and she bites the person next to her. again, it's like one of those unexpected things. You're like, what the heck? And then as the movie unfolds, like, we see more of her, like, stealing guns out of people's holsters and being like, this is a bullshit. Like,
the New York Times review from March of 1971 was particularly annoyed with her continued use of the word bullshit, both because they found it to be not funny. They found it to be vulgar without any real point. This came out soon after the film Love Story with Ryan O'Neal, and the female lead in that film apparently used the word bullshit a lot. And so it very specifically referred to the favorite 8-letter word of that character in order to say it without saying it in print in the Times. Like, that was a cultural reference that everybody in 1971, since everybody in 1970 had gone to see Love Story. I had to spend a good 7 minutes searching things in a weird way until I was finally able to put it together. I was like, communist? What is the word that is being referred to here?
You can't have too much help ferreting out them communists.
Odie, we're not ferreting out communists. We're looking for cigarettes.
Also what? The red devils.
But they were also very unhappy with the fact that she seemed to be using bullshit incorrectly. As you said, she says, this is a bullshit. And that wasn't funny to them either, that she was swearing badly and not just constantly.
You're a bullshit, Amos Bush.
Well, they don't know. What's your next one?
For my number four, it's a very simple thing that in the mass different scenes of marketing it takes place in the county fair that the town turns into, the constant 24-hour display. One of the things that they have is the cold turkey doll, which they advertise as, she smokes and she talks. She talks and she smokes. And they have this marvelous line where they pick up the doll and she says,
I love you. Smoking gives you cancer.
And as jokes go, I mean, classic combination of the sacred and the profane. To have this innocent recorded doll voice saying, you're going to die. It's beautiful. It's a standard joke, but I fell for it. And what's your number five moment, Anna?
My number five moment is one of the opening scenes in the movie is the Reverend preaching to his congregation, and they are not very engaged. But then
this
later,
is the first place that we see Odie actually is she's asleep in the pew, and when her, I assume, daughter nudges her to wake her up, which is also the same woman she bites. She gets mad and slaps her as if she had been the one that was sleeping.
And later in the movie, like sort of after the circus atmosphere arrives, they bring in a film crew to record the Reverend. And
my sermon for this morning is particularly relevant.
Hold it, hold it. I'm sorry, Reverend. Arnie, we didn't get a clear shot of the Reverend that time.
Want anyone take it again, Jerry?
This was actually, if I had had number five, it would have been in the same sequence. The filming of the preaching is such a good scene.
Yeah, it's really funny. And they like stop him and the Reverend sort of like, well, no, you were just supposed to like take pictures of us. You weren't supposed to interrupt us at all.
You promised that we were going to be able to do this uninterrupted.
And the guy who is, I mean, I guess he would be like a director type.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, no, I want you to like come over here a little bit. And can you cheat out? And then he like like goes down with chalk and like marks where the Reverend is supposed to stand. And it was very sort of meta. And
he's marvelously scummy. He has this fantastic, I've been dealing with show business people way that he talks.
Okay, folks, this is it. Now, everybody rise. Up, 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 up. Yeah, good group, good group. Now, look, you're singing your hearts out, right? Now, you dig the hymn and the words that the Reverend is laying on you, okay? So let's make it real. Make it live, all right?
And he sort of smirks and gives the Reverend a big thumbs up, and he calls him honey. And, oh, he's so astonishingly fake. I really enjoyed everything about his performance.
Yeah, it was a really fun scene. And I feel
I'm so glad you picked that. Yes.
Yeah.
Parsed Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcenamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.